Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hunt for the Safe by P.P. Cochran. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Chapter 1. The Dyson Sphere. 2,287 light-years from Earth. The small ship re-enters normal space, and its sensors sweep the surrounding area. Penetrating the blackness of space, its systems register the nearby gas giant, invisible to the naked eye. More lifeless planetoids are detected at the very edges of the system by the astrogation computer, which compares the sensor readings to the data stored in its core. It confirms the ship has indeed reached the desired destination, its makers programmed into it nearly 10 centuries earlier. The ship adjusts its position and ignites its powerful inter-system engines, which come to life, pushing it toward the heart of the dark and lifeless system. Appearances, however, can be deceiving. No light reaches out from a central star to kiss the outer planets. No radiation is detected to hint at the presence of a hidden star at the center of the planetary system. The planets seem to have formed against all known theories of system formation. Where is the system's star? The engines power down, and the ship coasts along its course, moving toward the center of the impossible planetary system. In the darkness, the sensors pick something up. A very weak signal, but definitely there. A latticework, like a giant spider's web, which forms a complete globe at least 2 AUs in diameter and situated exactly where the system's star should be. As the spacecraft closes in, it becomes apparent there are small bulges at some of the junctions where the fine latticework meets. Closer still, and the true size of the bulges are revealed as the structures dwarf the ship. The seemingly smooth, seamless skin of one of these structures splits, and a brightly lit docking area is revealed. The ship enters, and the structure's skin closes behind it like the mouth of a shark. The ship moves silently through the cavernous hangar, passing the sleeping behemoths of kilometer-long warships. All were painted the same inky black as the night sky. Flattened hulls with weapons pylons protruding above and below the main body, like fins of some enormous deep-sea predator. Gliding through another armored port, the ship passes yet more machines of war, until it finally settles into a snug docking cradle. Powering down its engines, the onboard computers link with the overarching artificial intelligence. The AI receives the information the small ship brings, detailing the fate of the chosen people at the hands of the Commonwealth forces. For what would be an eternity for any flesh and blood brain, but is in fact mere thousandths of a second, the AI ponders its next move until it finds the most compatible file. Instructions flash out to long dormant equipment.
Awaken.
Chapter 2. Survivors. Planet 2. Star System 52980, 107.3 light-years from Earth. Planet 2 of System 52980 steadily orbited its G-type main sequence star. The planet consisted of 6 large continents, making up about 1/3 of its surface. The remainder was covered in liquid water, forming deep oceans. Planet 2 was ideally located in its star system to be a viable life-bearing planet, but the others ensured whatever civilization may have sprung from its fertile ground would never have the chance to reach its peak. According to the drone's readings, the planet was subjected to an orbital bombardment sometime in the past 4 years. The bombardment had scoured the surface clear of life and plunged the planet's ecology into a new ice age, brought about by the nuclear winter clouds that still blanketed the planet's sky. Maybe in a few thousand years, when the ice began to recede and the radiation levels dropped, life would return to this dead world. For what it was worth, the perpetrators of this destruction suffered the same fate. Second Fleet, under the command of Admiral Robert Lewis, descended on the other's final sector base like avenging angels. The sector base was built into a large asteroid, circling a gas giant so massive it put Sol's own Jupiter to shame in a star system 15 light-years from its intended target. If nothing else, the others were consistent. They seemed only to build 2 types of base. The first was the sort the forces of Fifth Fleet encountered on 70 off Yukai, an orbiting facility designed to facilitate naval vessels, supported by a large ground installation. The second was of the type that faced Admiral Radford and Third Fleet out of Garunda, built into a large asteroid and surrounded by fire support bases mounted on smaller asteroids. Whichever style of base, they were always located in an adjacent system to the intended target. Therefore, if one knew the location of the base, it was a relatively simple matter of scouting nearby systems to find a planet that piqued the other's interest and so must be slated for destruction. Now, though, the 14th and last enemy base was neutralized. When the other's home on Narath was destroyed by its artificial intelligence, many thought it a simple matter of wiping up the remaining sector bases the enemy left behind. This cleanup operation took 3 years of hard fighting and cost the Commonwealth forces dearly in both ships and crew. Following the battle around Earth and the destruction of Narath, only Second Fleet retained its full strength. So to Admiral Lewis fell the mission of taking down the surviving enemy bases until First and Third Fleets had licked their wounds and regained their former strength. The first target of Second Fleet was the other's outpost in System 24901, a nondescript red giant star that had consumed the majority of the planets which once orbited it until what had probably been an icy moon of a now-vanished planet was its sole remaining satellite. This dwarf planet had developed a thin but breathable atmosphere around which the others built an orbital facility to support the two buzzards and one vulture that patrolled the system and the surrounding space. On the dwarf's surface was a fortified complex exactly like the one on 70 off Yukai, which had cost the lives of so many Marines in their futile attempt to capture it. Many of the Commonwealth's scientists and politicians refused to believe the detonation of nuclear weapons on 70 off Yukai and Narath was anything other than intentional. Lewis, however, was not one of them. He had read the paper written by now Lieutenant, junior grade, Terence Wilson, his wife's nephew, and it left Lewis in no doubt that the others, although not directly controlled by an artificial intelligence, certainly took direction from one. Lewis was determined that the waste of life, both friendly and enemy, would never be repeated. His initial assault plan was almost identical to the one employed by the ill-fated Fifth Fleet. Second Fleet emerged from Fold Space and launched a merciless missile attack on the orbital base and its warships. In fewer than 5 minutes, the orbital works and enemy warships were nothing more than floating wreckage. With the spaceborne threat neutralized, Second Fleet moved into low orbit. And as the rotation of the moon brought the surface base over the horizon, Lewis began his kinetic energy missile bombardment. The missile strikes threw tons of debris into the air, but ground-penetrating radar continued to identify targets for the fleet's missiles. Anything and everything looking remotely like a weapon or command and control facility was targeted. When the tactical officer was satisfied there were no viable targets left, Lewis ordered the deployment of the high-altitude electromagnetic pulse, hemp weapons. Blinding flashes lit the night sky high above the other's base as the weapons detonated in the stratosphere and their gamma rays were converted into a prodigious electromagnetic pulse. Every piece of unprotected electronic equipment within 100 kilometers ceased to function. Buried deep below the base, the artificial intelligence of the cultists noted that all feeds from the surface had been lost. The self-destruct protocol was activated, and the electronic signal triggering the ULF transmission and nuclear demolition charges was sent. It never reached its intended destination. Although the cultist was housed in a hardened bunker, the cables and equipment it was trying to activate was not. The hemp rendered the unprotected systems nothing more than expensive junk. When confirmation of the completion of its instructions was not received, the cultist moved to the next step in the protocol and initiated the thermobaric explosives embedded in the walls of its own bunker. The AI ceased to exist, leaving the soldiers on the surface to fight on without its guidance. The Marines of Second Fleet dropped right on top of the base, and no enemy fire rose to meet them. As they disembarked from the assault shuttles, they were met by enemy defenders, whose high-tech weapons were disabled by the hemp pulse. But still they attacked. They were reduced to swinging their useless weapons like clubs. Picking up rubble and broken masonry to use as additional weapons, they flung themselves upon the Marines. As reports from the ground flooded into the flag bridge, Lewis came to a decision. He ordered his Marines to switch to non-lethal weapons unless they were faced with no choice. Lewis understood this increased the risk of casualties among his Marines, but he refused to slaughter his enemy out of hand. On the surface, the Marines slung their plasma rifles over their shoulders, pulled out their pep pistols, and faced their charging enemy. In the end, the Marines managed to secure over 2,500 prisoners. It was the largest number ever captured alive, and Lewis was forced to request additional resources to help secure, house, and care for them. Units of the Girondin army were shipped in, and construction began of a vast prisoner of war camp. Their former enemy was now their responsibility. Over 3 years of conflict, this method of neutralizing enemy surface bases had been successfully deployed on 5 occasions and netted the Commonwealth nearly 15,000 prisoners, spread over 5 different star systems. However, they had not devised a similar method of minimizing casualties on the 2 enemy bases housed within asteroids. The combined Joint Chiefs of Staff, given no choice, ordered the assault fleet to stand off at a safe distance and pulverize the asteroid until there was nothing left except dust if the enemy commander failed to signal his surrender. Enemy fatalities were inevitably total. Images of the lifeless planets the Stealthy Reconnaissance Drone, SRD, returned to the fleet from the target planets of these enemy bases soon negated whatever pity was felt over the slaughter caused by the others' refusal to surrender. With grim resolve, the sailors and Marines went about their task of removing the threat the others represented to innocent life in the galaxy. Robert Lewis pushed himself back from the desk in his quarters on board the Bismarck-class battleship TDF Tsushima, musing over the report he'd been reading on the terminal while absently rubbing a hand over his tired face. The analysts had pored over the SRD's data and noticed an anomaly. It was certain that whatever life existed on Planet 2 was long gone, but as the SRD had egressed the system, it passed close to Planet 2's single moon. The compact electronic sniffer package on the probe, originally designed to detect stealthy enemy warships, had sniffed what the analysts were calling a non-natural occurring power source. So either the others had left something on the small moon, or there was some other party out there who was yet to reveal themselves. Well, there was only one way to find out. Some lucky soul was going to have to go and take a look. The Tanto-class shuttle lurched slightly as it moved clear of the Marine assault ship Sheridan. The heads-up display on Philippa's Wraith suit was configured to show the small ship's approach profile. The Sheridan had come out of fold space on the dark side of the small moon, exactly 180 degrees opposite the location of the power reading the reconnaissance drones had sniffed when they passed the moon during their final sweep of the dead planet it silently orbited. The Tanto, carrying Philippa and her platoon mates, was to spiral down to a height of 50 meters from the surface of the moon, and then approach the area flying Nap of the Earth. A quaint military phrase for flying as close to the ground as possible without running into the ground. The idea of which was to fly low enough to avoid enemy fire. It may have been uncomfortable for the passengers, but Philippa was willing to sit through a bumpy ride if it increased the shuttle's chances of making it to its target in one piece. Unfortunately, the brief glimpse the SRD had gotten only allowed the analysts to narrow the search area down to a few square kilometers, so the Tanto's crew was forced to fly a search pattern and use their more powerful equipment to localize the source. Philippa and her fellow Marines were there to babysit the scientists who would actually look at whatever was generating the power source. If they ever find it, and it wasn't just a glitch in the SRD's data, Philippa thought. The blinking incoming message icon appeared in her HUD. "Go for Papadomas," said Philippa, accepting the call. The slightly nasal voice of Lieutenant Travis came through her earbug. "Corporal, 5 mics till we reach the search area. Give your big brain types a gentle reminder the initial pass will be on passives only. Let's not go active on anything which may be mistaken for a fire control radar until we know more about what we're dealing with here, okay?"
"Understood, sir."
A small sigh escaped Philippa as she cut the link. She'd been lumbered with the unenviable task of herding the small scientific tech team while the platoon commander coordinated with the crew of the Tanto and the Marines under the first sergeant, who would deal with the security of the site when and if they needed to put boots on the ground. Philippa turned her head slightly so she could see the displays of the tech team's equipment and verify the systems were in passive mode. The senior scientist saw her and gave her a weak smile. Philippa's face, blank under her helmet, stared at him until he turned away in discomfort. Before leaving the Sheridan, she had a quiet word with the senior scientist and made it plain to him that if he questioned her instructions in any shape or form, she would personally ensure he spent the next few weeks in the Sheridan's sick bay. Now, the scientist wasn't a small man by any means. He was proud of his near-daily workouts in the Sheridan's small gym. But one glance into the diminutive Marine Corporal's steely eyes convinced him that perhaps following her instructions was a good idea. The Tanto slowed as it entered the search area, and the scientists focused their full concentration on the search for the elusive power source. The Tanto crisscrossed the search grid for nearly half an hour before the lead scientist cried,
"We've got it. 1,300 meters at 168 degrees. Definitely not a naturally occurring source. If I were to hazard a guess, I'd say it's a condensing nuclear reactor. Pretty old tech, but if properly maintained, it could run efficiently for decades."
Philippa only had one question.
"Is it the others?"
The scientist shook his head.
"We've never come across them using this type of tech, so my money is on no."
Good enough for Philippa. Changing channels, she called Travis.
"Lieutenant, the eggheads have a hit. 1,300 meters at 168 degrees. They're calling it a condensing nuclear reactor. Most likely not the others."
"Understood, Corporal. Let's firm up an exact location. Permission granted, go active on all sensors. Travis clear." It took another 10 minutes while the Tanto flew in a wide, sweeping circle, but eventually the senior scientist was satisfied his team had narrowed the location down to 15 meters below the dwarf planet's surface, in an area maybe 100 meters squared. It was as good as he was going to get. Philippa relayed the message to Travis, who came to a quick decision.
"Corporal, tell the scientists to seal up. I think it's time we stretched our legs. Between our suits' sensors and their portable gear, we should be able to get an exact fix on this thing. If it's buried, we need to know where to dig."
Travis had the Tanto set down a couple hundred meters from the source. As the dust settled, Travis's Marines disembarked and shook out into a skirmish line, while Philippa and her scientist charges, along with two more Marines as escorts, followed close behind. The Marines advanced toward the lip of a large meteorite crater, its bottom shrouded in darkness thanks to the high sides of the crater's walls blocking out the light from the distant red giant. Travis bounded to the lip and used his suit's passives to give the crater floor the once-over. Nothing. However, Travis had learned to trust his instincts, and the tickling sensation at the back of his neck was telling him something wasn't quite right about this. Well, his mission was to locate and identify whatever was generating the power source, and the only way to do so, apparently, was to go inside the crater. He chose to ignore his instincts just this once and activated his link to the platoon's first sergeant.
"First sergeant, take half the platoon around the lip of the crater and set up a fire support position at 90 degrees to our current location. Sergeant Morales will go firm here with the remaining Marines while I go forward with Papadomas and the eggheads and check out the crater floor."
As the Marines sprang into action, Travis continued to scan the crater's floor with his passives. Nothing seemed out of place, but buried in the center of the crater, not 100 meters from him, was a functioning nuclear reactor. The question was, who did it belong to? A telltale signal in his HUD changed from amber to green. The first sergeant was in position and happy with his Marines' positions. Travis continued to ignore the tickling sensation at the back of his neck as his well-honed instincts told him something was not quite right here. He took a deep breath before activating his link to Philippa and her charges.
"Let's move out. Eyes sharp, Marines."
With the two scientists between them, Travis and Philippa stepped over the lip of the crater and descended into the darkness below. As the inky blackness swallowed her up, Philippa switched her suit's optics to image intensifier mode, and the floor and walls of the crater jumped out at her in mixtures of green and gray. Cautiously, they advanced, reaching the center of the crater's floor without incident,
but the nagging sensation at the back of Travis's neck was still there, and judging by her overly cautious movements, he guessed the normally ice-cool Philippa could sense it too.
"Are you getting the same bad feeling I am, Corporal?" Travis asked over their link.
"You betcha, sir. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I get the distinct feeling we're not alone down here. I'm going to go to thermals to see if it makes any difference. Suit," she ordered. "Thermal image mode."
The world around Philippa shifted to a mixture of blues, reds, and yellows as the suit showed her the crater according to temperature variations. The crater's floor and walls were in shadow and should have been a uniform cool blue. But as Philippa scanned one small patch of wall, it appeared slightly warmer than the rest.
"Lieutenant, I have a heat variance on the crater wall at 10 o'clock.
Travis switched to thermal imagery himself and quickly spotted the anomaly.
"Okay, Corporal, go check it out. I'll cover you from here."
"Aye, aye, sir. Moving now."
Travis dropped to one knee, brought up his rifle, and placed the targeting dot on the heat source. A command to his suit pushed the aiming point over his link to the first sergeant and the fire support team. This action allowed everyone to see where Travis had his rifle aimed at. Now Philippa had the amassed firepower of the majority of the platoon to back her up if it all went wrong. Philippa noted the lieutenant's aiming point in her suit and was slightly reassured as she slowly approached the heat source. She noticed the heat source grew bigger as she moved closer and her optics got a better look at it. The source expanded in her HUD until a perfect horizontal line formed, about a meter and a half across. Faint red lines dropped vertically away from each end of the horizontal line, fading into a cool blue as they went.
"Are you seeing this, Lieutenant? It looks to me like heat escaping from a badly sealed hatch."
Travis called the image up to the corner of his own HUD.
Damn if she wasn't right.
Nature abhors straight lines, and those heat lines were perfectly straight and joined at right angles.
"Sit tight, Corporal. I'm coming to you."
Travis opened his link to the two scientists.
"Can your gear get me a good reading on whatever the hell that thing is?"
"Get me close enough, Lieutenant, and our equipment should be able to penetrate anything but battleship shielding," replied the lead scientist.
"Okay, you pair stay behind me and shout when we get close enough for you to get a good reading. Move out."
Travis moved off with the scientist trailing a few steps behind him. Just as they came level with Philippa, the scientist spoke over the link.
"That's close enough. I'm pushing the image to you now. It's some sort of airlock door to a narrow corridor cut into the rock. It slopes down at a shallow angle away from our position before skirting around and disappearing out of range about 15 meters below the surface."
The pause in the scientist's report got Travis's full attention.
"And?"
Travis asked, trying to keep the impatience out of his voice. For the briefest of seconds, the scientist said nothing. Then Travis saw in his HUD that both scientists were backing away.
"And there's something in the airlock now, and it's cycling."
"Crap. Corporal, heads up, we're about to have a visitor."
Travis's warning call came not a moment too soon. In Philippa's HUD, the thermal image bloomed as the airlock opened. Outlined in its center was a figure in cooler blue. Philippa's rifle came up, her aiming mark centered on the chest of the unidentified figure only scant meters from her. The alien seemed as shocked to find the Marines outside the airlock as they were to see the alien. Philippa saw the alien take a step back into the airlock. If whoever or whatever it was raised the alarm, the Marines could be in for a world of hurt. Before she realized she was doing it, Philippa sprang forward, her rifle falling slack on its sling and freeing her arms as she tackled the figure. She took it to the ground in a tangle of arms and legs. Philippa's Wraith suit's servos should have given her an unfair advantage, but as she tried to pin the alien to the ground, it managed to hold her off. Either it was incredibly strong, or it was being aided by its own mechanical suit. The fight came to swift end as Travis entered the airlock behind Philippa and leveled his PEP pistol at the alien's obscured faceplate. The space-suited figure got the message and assumed the prone position on the airlock's floor. Philippa pushed herself back to her feet, taking out her own PEP and quickly scanning the small airlock for threats. Lying by the door was a large metal case with the lid propped open. She took a tentative look inside to see a neat stack of a multitude of tools.
Is this guy on the floor a maintenance tech? Looks like some kind of tools to me, Lieutenant, she said as she completed her scan of the airlock. Satisfied they were alone, Philippa relaxed slightly, but kept her PEP at the ready. Maybe the alien still lying on the floor had friends on the other side of the airlock. Philippa moved to the airlock's open outer door. A cursory examination identified the control cables for the door's mechanism.
Lieutenant, if I cut this control cable, it should stop the door closing from the other side of the inner airlock. If their systems are anything like ours, it should be impossible to open the inner door while the outer one is still open. Might buy us some time to figure out our next move.
Good thinking, Corporal. Make it happen. Holstering her PEP, Philippa reached into her leg pouch and pulled out the small plasma cutter she always kept there. On activation, plasma as hot as the surface of the sun lanced out. Its thin arc cut through the control cables in seconds and disabled the outer door. Philippa moved back toward Travis, her PEP back out and leveled at the alien.
I've got this, Lieutenant.
Travis took a step back toward the outer door, pausing to inspect Philippa's handiwork. The outer door was out of commission, and her swift action gave him a few minutes to collect his thoughts.
Good work there, Corporal. Quick thinking with the tackle and the door.
A slight movement of Philippa's Wraith suit's helmet in silent acknowledgement was all Travis got in return for his plaudits. Travis recalled that he had been incredulous when the first sergeant recommended Papa Domus for the job of shepherding the scientists. Travis would have much preferred that one of the sergeants had the job. Papa Domus was the junior corporal in the platoon, less than 2 years out of training. Nevertheless, the first sergeant was quite insistent. If there was anything they taught you in officer training, it was to listen to your senior non-commissioned officers. So Travis bowed to the first sergeant's greater knowledge of the platoon. Watching Papa Domus in action, he was glad he had. She reacted more quickly than he to the rapidly developing situation. First, putting the alien out of action, then disabling the outer airlock door and securing their position for the moment. Back to the situation in hand, thought Travis. They had one prisoner, but God knew how many more were on the other side of the inner door. Of course, there was no definite proof that whoever was on the other side of the door was aggressive. If they wanted to get into a fight with his Marines, they would have sent more than one lone individual who, from what Travis could see, was not even armed. Travis gambled that whoever else was on the other side of the inner door did not know the Marines had been on the surface. Activating his link to the Tanto, he called the pilot.
Whistle up the Sheridan. It looks like we may have a first contact situation here. I'll pass you a copy of my visual data packet so they can make their own appraisal. Tell the Sheridan I'm requesting a full diplomatic team to take the lead here, and I need additional Marine units to secure the surrounding area out to at least a kilometer. If we found one airlock here, there might be more scattered around, and I don't want to be blindsided. Break. First Sergeant, let's get the men spread out into all-round defense. We may be here for a while.
In his HUD, a sparkling of points appeared as the First Sergeant repositioned the Marines. Maneuvers completed, Travis turned his attention to the still prone figure on the floor. Two arms, two legs, and a head. Any facial features were obscured by the tinted visor of the helmet. The pressure suit the figure wore looked a bit battered and had received some obvious repairs. On closer observation, Travis saw the suit seemed more bulky at the joints than it should. The way he'd been able to hold off Papa Domus might be explained by a battery-powered exoskeleton built into the suit. Well, they weren't going to learn much more until the first contact team arrived, at which point this particular problem wouldn't be his anymore. It would belong to someone on a much higher pay grade. A small beep signaled to Travis that his suit was trying to get his attention. The suit had detected a radio signal being generated from beyond the inner door and being received by the figure on the floor. Travis's suit could easily block the signal, but he decided not to. Any information they gathered on these aliens was advantageous to the work of the first contact team.
Suit, record all transmissions received and transmitted from the prisoner. Relay through the Tanto and mark it as priority information for the first contact team.
The suit emitted a single beep as it acknowledged his orders. Time seemed to creep by slowly as Travis, Philippa, and the two scientists, along with their prisoner, waited in the airlock. In reality, it was only 10 minutes since Travis passed his first contact report to the crew of the Tanto.
The two scientists laid their equipment on the floor in one corner and used it to scan beyond the inner airlock into the corridor beyond. Travis didn't like what the scans were telling him.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?